Blog Talk Radio.
All right, it's the Factory Whistle Show, UAW Factory Whistle Show. Scott, how are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing well. I'm hoping we can ever can hear me.
Can you? All right. We already have got people in the, I'll get 989 on. This is Jimmy. Get Jimmy on. We got a lot of people in the switchboard already. It's been there for a while. So if you'd like to join the conversation or start a conversation, just push 1 on your keypad and
good
take
evening,
it away.
Folks.
Good evening.
Good
Jimmy.
Evening.
Good evening.
I mean, yeah, there you go. There you go. Do the old Bela Lugosi, huh? Good evening. Yes.
Yes. I watched
so,
an old porn movie.
I hope everybody's team is doing what they was hoping they were going to do, and I think we'll have an interesting game I don't know when the next games are, but Michigan's in the Final Four, so there we go. Go Blue.
Next Saturday.
How's that? And then when's the final? I think my dad said they're on Easter Sunday.
Monday, aren't they?
Monday. And this week we won't have a show because it's Easter. So you can enjoy time with your family and friends and whatever you want to do. Or maybe you're just over 8 and you want to take a big long nap. I don't know.
Hey, while we're on that type of subject, can I ask a question to you two, Don and Scott? Being a convention and a contract year, please tell me we're going to keep this show going through the summer this year. I think it would be beneficial to every union member to keep this thing going.
Let's do it. It's all right with me.
This is true. It is contract year. We'll be
and convention.
Yeah. All rolled up in one fine package. Yeah, it's up to you guys. Fine with me.
I'm game with it if Scott's game with it. If you need a big ladle, Scott, I can bring one over. We can really stir up some stink.
There you go. I'll do the best. You know, I mean, I will.
You always do, brother.
Oh God, here we go.
All right, well.
We got to lie.
Oh, stop it. I told you, you sounded awesome, dude. So,
yeah.
No.
I wasn't here for none of that,
right.
So I guess I'm stinking up the pot. I'm sorry.
No, you're not stinking up the pot. I'll tell you what, who's stinking up the pot. They indicted another person this last week.
That's number 5, is it not?
Number 6, I believe.
You talking about Miss Johnson?
Yeah, I posted a picture of her out golfing. Wonder if she's golfing on our dime. Just a question.
I wonder if she's doing that limo ride.
Yeah, well, I don't know. All I know is it's getting ridiculous, and I know we're beating a dead horse around. But you know what? It makes some of us working people good to know that some of these people who've been shafting us for years are finally getting theirs. Okay, so
when are they going to stop the pleas and start convicting?
Don't know, but you know how that works out. Usually, pleas lead to something else.
Oh, yeah.
So
I'll rat on the next rat, I'll rat. Like I said, we're 2 rats away from Dennis Williams, aren't we not?
I think so. That's a fine way to look at it. And I don't think this is, I don't, like I said, I don't think this is done. Like I said, 3 weeks ago, I posted on workers, workplaces, unions, and some other people I think might have posted. I don't know if they did, but, you know, they've all let their charities drop. Imagine that.
Well, yeah. Where's Brian Keller when we really need it to sound shitty? But the point being is... They're only playing with Chrysler, folks. We got 2 more companies and a whole lot more charities to go after. Are they giving them enough time to clean it up? I hope not. I don't think they will, but like I said, when are the plea deals going to stop and we're going to start getting convictions? I'm tired of hearing about somebody slinging soup for wasting our money.
Right. All right.
Well,
let me get
like you
Paul
said, you know,
on the line. Hold on. Paul's on the line. Let me get him on. Okay, Paul, go ahead.
The whole thing reminds me of what they say, that there's no honor among thieves. They'll all roll over on one another. You know, the thing is, we didn't have any way to cleaning it up ourselves because the UAW is a one-party system, and as long as they were all getting the feed at the trough, everybody was going to be happy. But as soon as the feds got in there, it's a different story, and you have to remember that these people at Chrysler, many of them started another company like General Motors. So we know this practice is probably system-wide within the UAW. So the dominoes are going to fall at Ford and General Motors too.
Exactly. You know, I'm glad you brought that up, Paul, because for people who don't have a little bit of automotive history amongst themselves, the executives and the upper echelon management people were at times through the 70s and the 80s, they were interchangeable. I mean, how many times did Iacocca work for General Motors or Ford, you know, before he wound up, I think he worked for Chrysler three times, you know, and people, like you said, they interchange. And when you have management people like this interchanging, I think that it's safe to say that they maintain those relationships with those people that they've dealt with from the union. I think it's safe to say, don't you think?
Well, yeah, plus, like I said, like some of these people that are union executives over the Chrysler department, they started out at General Motors. So,
right,
you know, the region that they came
right.
from was probably corrupted too.
Right, right. I mean, because you had, well, you know, a good example would be Norwood. Norwood had, he was a regional director. He worked in then, I mean, Mr. Jewell has a history all of his own in this area and with other people on this show, I may also say, you know, and he ends up looking like he's going to be VP General Motors. And whatever Cindy Estrada did, she wound up, I'm sure that had Frank White's help in there somewhere along the way. She wound up vice president General Motors Department instead of Norwood. So, you know, like I said, that's a prime example of that.
Well,
you know,
the
by the way, when I mentioned, go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, even if these people didn't do anything that was illegal under the law, the thing is, that, and I'm sure there's many cases where they did, the thing is it's tainted our union because, you know, when you're in leadership position, you should think a way thing of how things look in the eyes of the membership, paying membership.
Absolutely. I mean, sometimes appearance is everything. You
right.
know, is it? Was it? Well, I mean, we can say it now, but on appearance, people would ask, is that moral or is that ethical?
Yeah.
Or, you know, you're doing some things that are very yeah. questionable. They may not be illegal, but you would say maybe they're on moral. Depends on where your
yeah.
moral standards are. Like people, like all these guys picking up this money from the VEBA.
Right.
I hear somebody talking. Okay, anyway, people don't know that that money from the VEBA, they are titled, if I'm correct, they are entitled honorary trustees of the VEBA fund.
Right.
So the president Williams, gets almost $30,000. The VPs and the financial secretary get almost $29,000.
Right.
And then the regional directors also get some money. I don't know if the assistant region directors do or not, but I know the regional directors get almost $28,000.
Right.
Now, to you and I, we think that's wrong. Okay, we know that that VEBA is gonna is the retirees' health care fund, the future pensioners' health care fund. And these guys are getting in there, and they're getting made money out of this.
Yeah. Well, I think what it boils down to this, I don't care. I think they should be transparent about what they get. But I think overall, I don't think the membership cares if they're millionaires as long as they represent the membership with integrity. But the problem is that's not happening. About 15 years ago, I was talking to one of the old-timers from my plant, and he told me he had talked to a shop committee man who told him this, and I think this is the problem. The shop committee man said there's no such thing as right or wrong anymore. It's just negotiated issues. And that,
what?
Now, this is what a shop committee man had told him years ago, and I think that's what the problem is. Our union leaders no longer have a moral compass. They don't have a set of moral absolutes. It's just what they do is they respond to whatever management wants. And the thing is, they're supposed to have a moral obligation to represent the membership. You know, what management wants shouldn't even matter. What should matter is what the people on the plant floor want. They're elected, and they move up the ladder to represent the people that pay dues. You know, they shouldn't give one rip what management wants.
Dick, you're on, and there you go.
And I agree. You're absolutely right. The membership should come first. We are the union. And because, like you said earlier, they are self-governing until that changes, you know, you're always going to, even if we get this whole bunch of crooks out, like Richard would say, you replace these crooks with a whole new batch of crooks. You know, it's imperative that people understand the process and how you want to do this to get this done. It could be done. It's possible. But I don't know. So,
all right.
What do you, I mean.
People in the
right.
Support, push one on your keypad. And Dick, you are on. I don't know if you know.
Hello.
I got one question.
Hello,
that
sir.
I learned today. Scott, I had a funeral, and I went down to the thing today. Now, this was a man that I got in at American Axle right before I left. He transferred around trying to save his career there. As we all know, they ultimately lost. But I did not know until today that like 80% of them were picked up by Chrysler within 3 months of losing their job. Now, this guy I went to today, he actually literally, he'll probably read he died and transferred, but he fell over dead on the shipping dock in the, I think it was the Mopar plant in Warren or Centerline. That being said, I was just kind of shocked on how they all wound up at Chrysler, and they weren't, you know, he never was a GM employee. He was hired by Dick Dowd and American Axle. But when they went down,
right.
Apparently our union had to meet all over the city in different locations. And ironically, I met some guys there that I used to represent who are now in the stamping plant in Woodhaven. Some of them are over on this side of the city. But I was shocked that I didn't know that all of them did wind up going with Chrysler, which I guess is a good thing, but then listening to their woes, they don't have a pension. They thought they had a pension with AAM, and we all know how that worked out for everybody, you know, along with my terms of
right.
Terms of discrimination.
Right. Jeez. No, I did not know people were picked up by Chrysler.
I didn't know that. I mean, I did not know it. Now, he had 9 years in with American Axle at the time of separation when they, I don't know what they do. They went belly up, didn't they? Because I know they went on strike, and then I think he just moved to Mexico, I believe.
Thailand and then Mexico.
Yeah.
Thailand and then from Thailand to Mexico. So, yeah.
Where's Dick? Isn't he supposed to have the floor?
Yeah, Dick's here.
I'm here.
Okay.
He's just listening, I think.
I don't know. I thought he had comments.
Well, I have one. On the VBA, Dennis Williams and the vice presidents are member of the board of directors of the VBA. They're not trustees.
Okay.
And they get paid for that.
So the regional directors are also members of that board then?
The regional directors have nothing to do with the VBA.
Then why are they collecting funds from VBA?
Why are they doing what?
They are getting paid almost $29,000 a year from the VBA.
The regional directors are?
Yes.
Where are you getting that information?
I pulled that off of tax forms a while ago. And they are, maybe that's who the honorary trustees are on the VBA. But the regional directors are also collecting funds off of, they're getting a wage off the VBA.
You're sure the money is from the VBA and not Department of Labor grants they have in their regions?
Yes. Yes.
I was not aware that the regional directors, the only UAW full-time people that I have seen listed on the VBA are the members of the board of directors, and that's Dennis Williams and the vice presidents.
Right. Well, on the tax forms, on the 904s, they're receiving funds from the VBA.
What is a 904 tax fund?
It's a tax form that they file. Anyway, all I'm saying is they all are pulling money.
Wait a minute. I never heard of a 904 tax fund.
I know
there's a 990
tax
for nonprofits that they file in the states. Are you talking about their IRS income tax forms, or are you talking about data you found on the LM2?
Both. They were on the LM2, and it might be the 990, not the 904. All I remember, it's been a while.
The 990s don't show up on the LM2. You have to request them state by state.
Well, somebody that we know got me a copy, and they were there. Let's just put it that way.
Well, somebody could have requested. There are training fund grants that have been around for 40 years that the DOL issues, and the regional directors are the chairman of that nonprofit training fund grant, and their salaries range in that $28,000 to $30,000 range over the past 30 or 40 years.
Right. No,
and
this,
the money
this,
that
this
they...
This has specifically VBA on it. It says VBA. That's all it says is VBA.
Well, how many side gigs can those guys have?
Well, I don't know, because the final settlement agreement on the VBA very clearly has sealed in perpetuity the names of anybody who plays any role in the VBA from the UAW other than the members of the board of directors.
Why is that?
Because the UAW did not want anybody knowing what international representatives are playing what roles in the VBA. For instance, there is a job in the final settlement agreement called the liaison. That is a person appointed by the president of the international union. And that person is actually the representative of the president to the VIBA. And that person has access to all meetings, records, files, and minutes. That person has been unnamed. The first one was Dick Shoemaker. Well, the first one was Dan Sherrick, the legal counsel. The next one was Dick Shoemaker. And all right. I have is rumor that when Shoemaker left, Cal Rapson's got that job. That's only rumor.
Yeah.
But there is a person who acts on behalf, and that is his full-time job, to be able to answer any question about anything that the president of the union wants to know about. And so that person has universal access. And as far as the salary of that job goes, it's got to be way up there.
So
it's a full-time job.
We don't know what the salary is then, eh?
We don't know the salary, and we can never know the name of the person.
And how is it they could set up something like that?
Because the judge approved it.
It was pretty interesting because when we were voting on the VIBA and, people were fighting it, one individual put out a letter saying that what they were doing with the VIBA is they were going to create kids jobs for their kids and grandkids. And sounds like that's the way it is.
The VIBA personally occupies the top floor of the Walker Avenue building, the Human Resource Center.
Yeah.
They have the whole top floor. I still have not been able to determine who owns that building.
Yeah. Do we know
Argonaut? I thought maybe Argonaut Realty, the real estate branch of General Motors, built that building, and then the joint programs were leasing it from them. But I don't know what the ownership is on that building. But the VIBA now has the whole top floor of the Human Resource Center down on a river on Walker Avenue. Now, there's a lot of people employed there. There are secretaries who would belong to the OPIU, and there are international reps who would be assigned to that because you have one Master Trust VIBA. But then you have departments for the VIBA, such as the GM, the Ford, and the Chrysler Department. Moreover, the UAW has VIBAs with, like, Caterpillar, John Deere. They have had these VIBAs for many years now. So you have people from those departments involved in the VIBA. And what the UAW wanted when they did the final settlement agreement coming out of the bankruptcy is they didn't want anybody knowing who was assigned to that. So we have no way to know not only how many people from General Motors staff are assigned to the Human Resource Center in skill development and training, health and safety, and any other joint program they have down there, which are joint fund reimbursed jobs, which create an income stream for Solidarity House, let alone how many international reps and secretaries whose wives, daughters, sisters, nieces, and cousins have the clerical support jobs on the fifth floor down there. Those names are all sealed where it comes to the VIBA. There's nothing sealing the names of the people who are assigned to the HRC. All the people on the staff when the contract was settled in 2015 are listed in the back of the UAW-GM agreement. They're all listed there. And if you know how to read the list, you can see who's actually in the GM department, who's an international rep. But it doesn't tell you where they're working and on what.
Well, what accountability is there? I mean, it's like, you know what, a question that kind of popped into mine was this. I turned 65 this year.
Uh-huh.
And a whole bunch of us start turning 65,
uh-huh.
and Medicare starts picking up 80% or whatever it is of our medical bills, what's going to happen to that VEBA? Is it going to be just one gigantic slush fund that doesn't really serve any purpose other than to just pay
Let me say this to you, Paul.
Okay.
Once you're on Medicare.
Yeah.
Now, when I retired, I was 63 and I qualified for Medicare, and that's why I retired.
Okay.
So when I was 63, I went on Medicare. Now, you got to understand something. The VEBA is essentially bridge insurance. You may see these ads on the internet or whatever saying bridge insurance. So what happens is people who are retired, unless they took 30 and out, the people who retired at 30 and out, say when they were 48 years old,
right?
Those people's health care is being paid completely by the VEBA until they're 63.
Right.
Once you're 63, the VEBA becomes a bridge insurance for you, paying the difference between what Medicare paid and what your actual bill is. So when people look at Medicare or the VEBA, they think, oh, they're paying everybody's health care. Most of the people who are in the VEBA is only making up the difference between what Medicare pays and what the bill is. It's not paying completely for everybody's health insurance.
Yeah.
Unless the people who are in it took 30 and out.
Right. Well, that's my question is, you know, when all of us that retired early, who've had VEBA covering our medical insurance, all of a sudden, the VEBA is just picking up the difference after what Medicare pays. What's going to happen to this fund? Because it seems to me like there's going to be a lot less drain on the fund, and seems like the VEBA is just going to be a big slush fund that doesn't really serve any purpose anymore other than just to pay international reps, their kids, their friends, their...
No. Now, wait a minute.
Salaries, I mean.
Paul, that VEBA under ERISA law only pays the health insurance for people who are in the defined benefit pension plan.
Right.
Now, as time has gone on, that VEBA, the final settlement agreement, was in 2009. Okay, now it's 2018.
Right.
So people who retired at 30 and out, or who had retired at 30 and out in 2009, even if they were 48, are coming close to Medicare now.
Right.
Very shortly, what your anticipation is that everybody in the VEBA is only going to be using it as bridge insurance.
Exactly.
And that is why last year, the demographics now, the people who were being fully covered as opposed to the people who were just getting bridge insurance, the people fully covered number has diminished quite significantly since 2009, obviously.
Yep.
Because just age overtakes you. So what they said last year was, all of a sudden the past 2 years, the VEBA has been doing better. Well, that's because more and more people have gone from completely being covered to just having it as bridge insurance. So
right.
What you're saying is so, if everybody's in there on bridge insurance, then that's only got to cover that 20%
right.
of what Medicare doesn't pay. And so that's what they were counting on. The big argument was in 2009, it's going to run out of money because everybody thought it was going to be paying total health insurance, which was a false premise.
Right.
So what has happened is because they actuarially calculated that out in 2009, General Motors went in the court for the final settlement agreement, got relief of $10 billion less than what they were going to give the VEBA. And then it was a big brouhaha, and Gettelfinger came in the newspaper and said, no, we've looked at this, and the Viva's not going to run out of money. Well, they've looked at it because more and more people were only going to be covered 20% in the form of bridge insurance.
Yeah.
So from the standpoint of the viability and the longevity of the Viva, it looks like the Viva is not going to run out of money.
Right.
So it will be there. And now they have sold off 40 million shares. Now, 140 million shares of their stock. And it's a good thing they've done. The stock is down $2 or $3 now for cash because they're going to invest it in other parts of the market. And so I think the viability of the Viva is fine. And I, what I really believe, though, is it's become a monster bureaucracy.
Right.
But don't forget, they've been doing this. The UAW Viva has been doing this now, Kent, for almost 8 or 9 years. They understand the business now. They appear to be doing a pretty damn good job of it. They have gone from cursory eye care to better eye care and dental. And as people stop falling off of the 30-odd people and everybody becomes a bridge, then they can better manage their money because they know what it is. And they're investing their money now. They had that big chunk of GM stock. They're still a large stockholder.
Right.
And there's an argument now about since they've sold this $140 million, are they entitled to a seat on the board? And
right.
That debate is going on right now. So if we're not automatically entitled because we have 140 million shares less, then what has to happen is we have to fight a proxy battle on the floor to elect a person based on the shares that we do have.
Right.
I frankly do not see any advantage to the Viva of having a seat on the board of General Motors.
Well,
I mean, any Wall Street analyst can tell you the viability of General Motors. We don't need an ex-vice president sitting there trying to figure out if General Motors is going to survive or not. Because as far as the Viva is concerned, it doesn't matter anymore.
Right. Well, no, what I was saying, I'm not afraid the Viva is going to run out of money. My point is, that as we all age out, go on Social Security and die, I think they're going to have a monstrous pile of money left.
Well, it's the same thing with the pension fund.
What's that?
It's the same thing with the pension fund, Paul.
Yeah.
I mean, right now there's about $59 billion in the pension fund, and it's marginally 80%, 80, 85% funded.
Okay.
Now, as we die off, because they've closed the pension fund, and not only have they closed it, but in a 2011 contract, people stopped earning any pension credits. So right now, Shingledecker and Mattis and all the rest of the guys who are out there who are eligible, who are grandfathered into the fund, they're not even earning any pension benefits. Their benefits don't go up, they're not earning any more credit. So you've got people in the plant now who've been working probably for 7 or 8 years earning no more pension credits. So now now they've closed it, and the people who were eligible stopped earning pension credits the end of the first year of the 2011 contract. So nobody's earning any more. There's no more increasing liability to the pension fund at all. Whatever you were getting in 2012, that's what you're getting for the number of years you had right then and there. 30 years with some automatic payments that gave you flat payments up to $250 a year, but Shingledecker and Mattis ain't earned any more increase in their pension fund in years now.
Yeah.
So now it's a closed fund. And you're right, and it's like the Viva. All we do now, because we know what the end game number's in, and in the insurance industry, which is the pension business too, the actuarial calculation says, as these people die off on the front end, the people who are there, we can say this is how much money Jimmy Mattis is going to get till the day he dies, and he's never going to get any more. So now they can better manage the money. And right now in the GM pension fund, there are 12 investment companies. They took $14 billion out of the pension fund, and they invested it in 12 pension Wall Street companies. They were investing the money themselves, but now they've got these 12 investment houses that are doing private investment for the pension fund. Now, what happens is when we're all dead, whatever's left of that $59 billion, General Motors just gets.
Okay.
It goes back to the corporation because it's still their pension fund. The VEBA is a different story. They don't have any claim in the end game on any of the money in the VEBA. But on the pension fund, when we're dead, they get what's left.
Okay.
What happened this last national contract was they changed the language on the pension funds. And what happened is if the set amount goes below a percentage, the people who have who were hired before September of 2007 who are getting a pension, if that amount goes below a certain level, they don't accrue any pension funding until that amount goes back up to another certain amount. So they give themselves an insurance policy on their pension funds.
Yep.
And that's just, that's terrible.
Well,
What I'm trying to say here real quick, Paul, is if that person has 25 years and this funding goes to this level, it might take them 5 years to get that level back up to that percentage. For that 5 years, you don't accrue any pension funding. You may have to work another 5 years to get a 30-year pension.
Wow.
Well, don't forget, there are federal funding levels, Scott. They can't let it go down to 50%.
Right.
It's got to be a minimum, an absolute minimum of 85% funded, because General Motors 2 years ago took out a bond issue to put $1.3 billion into the pension fund.
Right. And then this last year General Motors sold off stock for pensions too. Or just this year they did that.
Sold off stock for pensions?
Yeah.
What are you talking about?
Yeah.
You can't fund an ERISA-based plant with company stock.
Conflict
of
interest?
It goes back to the Enron scandal in Texas.
Oh, okay.
They changed the law, and companies cannot fund defined benefit pension plans with company stock.
No, what they did was they sold the stock off to put the money into the pension fund.
Sold what stock off, Scott?
They sold some stock off here in the last – this year they did this. They sold off, I want to say, 1.3 million.
They sold bonds,
stock.
Scott. They sold bonds.
Maybe it was bonds. Bonds.
That's not stock.
I knew they sold something. Right.
They created a bond issue. Because they don't have the cash. They say they've got $35 billion in cash, but they don't. The cash on their asset sheet is about $21 billion. They started out coming out of the bankruptcy with $35 billion in cash. They've managed to blow that down to $21 billion. Moody's, who is the bond agency, gave them investment-grade bond status, provided their actual cash never went below $20 billion. So for all practical purposes, that $20 billion does not exist to be touched by General Motors. They call that the fortress bank account because they'll lose their bond standing. So what they've done now is go back to credit card funding, otherwise defined as issuing bonds or getting lines of credit. They have three times changed their line of credit and added to it. So when you look at their liability and assets sheet, it will say assets of $35 billion. Then below that, it'll say liability, and it'll say what the liability is on the union and management defined benefit pension plans. Right now, the end of the year 17, if you took the total cash and cash available, they're two different things, and subtracted their liabilities, they've got liabilities on pension funds in Asia, in Europe, and in management, and us. They're about $10 billion in the hole on all their benefit liabilities, not just us, and what they have in cash and access to cash.
Wow.
Did I?
Hey, Dick?
Yep.
I have a question about some of this bargaining. You know, when I've looked at some of the contracts that we've gotten over the years.
Yep.
A question that popped in my mind is, were these people sober when they bargained these contracts, especially when we hear what happened to, what, you know, what Icabelli pleaded guilty to is, are these people really sober? Are they drunk? Are they under influence when they bargain this stuff?
I will say, you might want to say, Dick, were they insane to some degree? I would say yes. Were they drunk? No.
Okay.
Were they under
really
influence
don't have
or
a real
something?
Excuse.
You've got to understand, when you work at one of those training centers. Now, I went to the UAW GM training center where there were only 10 of us assigned to it. And we were in office we were in offices in the Fisher building. And then we went from there to a one-story office complex near 16 Mile and Big Beaver Road until a three-story building out at M59 got built. And we walked into that building, and here were three 25,000-square-foot floors, brand new, with state-of-the-art offices in it, a board of directors room on the third floor, co-director's office, like CEOs, and then each of the departments. And we had 15 joint programs at the time. And we were all housed in that building. It had a cafeteria and all that stuff. And money was not a problem. I had quality of work life. I had the discretion to write anything up to $1,000 without having any checks on it. In other words, I could spend $1,000 in joint funds, $1,000 at a time, okay? I didn't have to go to my coordinator and say, Ted, I need a box of pencils. That's the way Don Eflin set the place up. So we had to run our offices, and I could buy anything with that, computers, furniture for the office. I spent $25,000 building a quality work-life library. There were four offices, a conference room, and I took the conference room and made it a library, and a meeting room was quality work life, which is what I had the control over. So, but we didn't have that kind of graft. I mean, I decided I wanted my secretary to have a Macintosh computer. It was $3,000, so I wrote her five $1,000 vouchers and said, buy the best Mac you can. and my secretary was the only one in the building that had a Mac, which made everybody crazy. Now, in terms of the kind of graft that's going on, now, we had a board of directors, just like they had a board of directors at the Chrysler Training Center. Don Eflin and Al Warren had an office the size of your living room right across the hall from the boardroom. We had a very expensive boardroom that would seat probably 20 people on each side of the table. And they met every month. And then the heads of these activities would go in before them and say, this is what we did in quality work life. This is what we're doing in health and safety. This is what we're doing with the appendix program. This is what we're doing with tuition assistance program, with child care program, just like a regular company with the department's reporting. So there was nothing Al Warren nor Don Eflin did not know that was going on in the building, because they had their day-to-day managers of the building in Don Davis, who was assistant director in the GM department staff, and a guy named Ken McCormick, who was a lawyer from the industrial relations department. They were the two joint day-to-day managers of that facility. And Chrysler and Ford were set up the same way. Now, it's hard for me to imagine that Al Warren would have gone to Don Eflin and paid off his mortgage to get a concession agreement, because Al Warren would not have done that. This guy, Iacobelli, just happened to be the kind of guy, and there can be no doubt in my mind that Sergio Marchionne knew exactly what he was doing. Because the way the funding happens now in the centers, it doesn't happen at 19 cents per hour and an overtime penalty based on the number of hours that people are working in the plant. In a 2007 agreement, that funding formula went away because we all knew how much money there was. If there was 275,000 hourly workers in GM in 1985, then we knew on a 40-hour basis, it was 19 cents an hour times 275,000 people. Now, we didn't know exactly how much overtime people were working, but you knew at least on a 40-hour basis how much money we were generating every year. Now, that disappeared in 2007, and the company just said, we will make money available. If you look at the 2007 highlights at Ford, GM, and Chrysler, you will see language to that effect. The funding formula is discontinued, and from time to time, when funds are needed, the company will make the money available. Now, that provides a breeding ground for corruption, no doubt about it. Now, I don't think that happened in GM, and I don't think that happened at Ford. But all it takes is an operator like Marchionne, who gets an Al Warren-type guy to head up his labor relations, and he's an operator, he's a player, and what does he do? He gets hold of Hollifield. And Hollifield decides to go on the take. Well, if you can corrupt him, then you can corrupt the people below him. But right. For this guy to set up with an accounting guy from corporate accounting, charge cards for these people to go off and spend the kind of money that they're spending and hide that in the SEC funding reports to the federal government, then you got to know that's real corruption. And it takes a guy in management to do that. And the kind of money this guy's talking about, a total of what we know so far, $4.5 million. I mean, I don't care how big Chrysler is, $4.5 million is still $4.5 million. How the hell do you cover that up without that coming to the attention of Marchionne? You don't.
Well, then shouldn't all these boards of directors be held responsible, too?
Because the people on the boards of directors of Ford, GM, and Chrysler National Training Centers, there is the vice president of the UAW and the head guy from industrial relations from the corporation. They are the CEOs. the president and chief operating officers are the two co-directors.
Okay.
Those are the day-to-day managers of the place.
Okay.
And so the day-to-day manager at the NGM was Don Davis. He reported directly to Don Eflin. When they had a board of directors meeting once a month, we all knew there was a monthly meeting. Then all the heads of all the different operations went in and said, here's the money I asked you for to do my operation this year. Here's what I've spent this last month. I'm within my budget. I'm over my budget. You give them a copy of your financials. The HRCs had a chief accountant. There was a financial guy there. And there is on all three of them. So this wasn't, it couldn't operate with that kind of money in a closet, Paul, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, so what I'm saying is, shouldn't the directors be held responsible, too, for what was going on? Because don't they have...
Well, there has to be a certain amount of accountability and responsibility and liability for the members of this board of directors who are in there. I don't know who else. You know, there are managers on these in the UAW, in the department staffs, right? We
yeah.
have foreman, general foreman, and superintendent level guys in the GM department on the staff. You understand that, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And they're
yeah.
at will, and they are at will employees. They are appointed by the vice president. They serve at his will, just like Trump says, I'm making you, Tillerson, the Secretary of State. Now I'm mad at you and you go back, you're out of here. That is the status of their employment. And you have a foreman level called a coordinator. You have a general foreman level called an assistant director. And you have a superintendent level called an administrative assistant. They are at-will employees. They leave the staff council. They get $5,000 to $10,000 a year more. They got a whole bunch of perks that nobody knows about, and they are the managers on the staff. So there's a hierarchical bureaucracy in each of these department staffs. Now when you get out to the centers, the training center, what you have is that you have the day-to-day manager guy who is on the at the training center. See, all we're hearing about is Norwood, Jewell, and Hollifield, and Icabelli.
All right.
What about the co-directors of that operation? We managed, with the corporation, to sweep those two day-to-day operational managers under the rug so far, haven't we?
Yeah. That's what
so
I
now
think.
What that tells me is they were either kept totally in the dark about this, because that money that Icabelli was given to these union people was invisible to their budgets that they turned in to run the various departments in the center. That money was on top of money and taken from the finances of Chrysler, which is why you got this one guy, the second guy convicted, was a financial guy from Chrysler Financial. Dewar or something was his name. He was taking that money straight from Chrysler.
But here's a question. I guess I've said this all along. If one of them's guilty, they're all guilty. And the reason I must
well,
say that
I
is
think,
because...
I think the money only went down to a certain level below Hollifield. It didn't get any
right.
lower.
Right.
These
then
were all
Norwood
these two
Jewell.
Women that were these two women were at that superintendent level. They were both administrative assistants. Johnson
Jewell,
and Verdell King.
But Jewell,
I think the money
Jewell
was
this.
Kept.
Norwood Jewell did this. Hoilford's been dead. Norwood Jewell was doing
Norwood Jewell walked into it. He didn't do anything. He walked into what was already there.
And he continued.
Obviously.
Okay. So what I'm saying is, if one of these departments is guilty, they're all guilty because you know as well as I do.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute.
Gary,
there's no department here. These are all administrators in the UAW department.
I think what he means is more GM and Chrysler. Do you not?
Thank you, thank you. And Gary Castile and Dennis Williams, they're aware of this too.
Well, when they went over to the National Training Center on Jefferson Avenue, which has now been sold, when they went and it's moved in out to Warren, Jimmy, to that building you and I saw, which was the World Class Manufacturing System.
Correct.
Remember that? John Barbosa told us they have moved the National Training Center into that building, if you remember.
I do.
So that's where the National Training Center is over there now.
I know, but what I think Scott was trying to say is we know Chrysler is dirty. But
Bob King became aware of the charity. He confronted Hollifield, and it said he had two other people with him. We still don't know who they are. At the time, Dennis Williams
was the
financial secretary, okay? And it came to Bob King's attention as the president of the local, and there's a free press article which documents the conversation where King said to Hollifield, "This charity is looking like a violation of the law, and you've got to stop it." Now, this is what a reporter got from King.
But he didn't stop it.
But he didn't stop it, but he was aware of it when he was president.
Well, shouldn't he have been morally or ethically obligated?
I don't want to talk about should be, could be, ought to be, okay? You guys can do that.
Fall under aiding and abetting? You can bet your sweet ass if Scott or me did it, we'd be filed charges for aiding and abetting.
Whatever you say.
You're here.
Well, that's law.
Whatever you say.
So what he is trying to get to, Dick, is if Chrysler's guilty, he believes Ford and GM are probably as guilty as well.
I don't think the finances work the same way. You don't have a Nicabelli at GM or Ford, as far as I know. I've not seen any evidence.
No, you got a Cindy Estrada, who is still under investigation, by the way.
And Cindy Estrada is under investigation for her charity.
Correct. And going to end up being, it's almost the same situation, Dick. That's how they got
as far as the charity goes, the federal government has told Cindy, Dennis, and who the hell else is it? The guy and Jimmy Settles, that they are not allowed anymore. They've ordered them federally to take no more donations to their charities, and so they've let those charities go dormant.
Correct. So. What I'm saying is they're under investigation.
Jones did he not? He had two charities, but they can't ever prove where anything was put in on the fire.
One charity was set up at Dennis Williams' direction by Gary Jones, but no money was ever put into it.
That's what I just said.
Now, also with that being said, Cindy Estrada didn't have one, but she had three charities.
Right.
Instead of her name being on the other charities, she put her administrative assistants as the head of those charities.
Yeah, she used guys from her staff.
Yes,
not
she
in
did.
Charge,
and,
but
and,
on the boards. She remained the chairperson, but people from her staff were on the boards.
So what my train of thought is here, and this is the real world, I think, which we live in. Chrysler. We knew that we didn't want Chrysler to be the lead plant going negotiations because they're the worst off. And historically, we've never done that. They got a sweetheart deal because we know the outside influence, keep them fat, happy, and dumb. They are on the take. I believe that did affect the negotiations for a national agreement. And then knowingly, Dennis Williams, with his staff and his other VPs ran tried to run those same contracts again at General Motors and at Ford.
Now, your thinking is a little screwed. I think what happened was this. I think that Holifield made the deal with Ecobelli for that horrible contract that got turned down by Chrysler.
Ecobelli told Holifield,
this is what we'll negotiate. Holifield told Dennis Williams, here's what we'll negotiate. But Dennis Williams had to have a meeting with Sergio Marchionne before negotiations started because they set out the fence lines for the contract. And I think that Dennis Williams went with Chrysler for one reason. They were going to give a big-time concession deal to Chrysler in 2015. And Dennis's thinking was the opposite of what you do. You go to the richest company, get the best contract, then you drag the other two kicking and screaming into it. Dennis turned the table on this one after meeting with Marchionne and went where he knew he was going to get the worst contract, and then he was going to drag GM and Ford down to that level.
Right.
Only the whole thing blew up in their face.
Holifield was dead when this happened. Norwood Jewell did this. Holifield was already dead.
The deal was done before Holifield died, Scott.
Holifield.
All Norwood had to do was sell it. All Norwood had to do was sell it, and he did that under Dennis Williams' orders. That's why I think Dennis Williams is dirty here.
Well, Dick.
That's why he hasn't said shit with a mouthful. He can't.
Dick, why?
He doesn't.
Why?
Okay.
Dick, I'm wondering, why is it these union people think it's appropriate that every contract the people go backwards? And why do they think that the membership is crazy enough to continue to go along with that?
Because they've been doing it since 2009. That's why.
Because they can. Okay. They don't believe there's a point at which the membership is finally going to rebel?
The membership won't do it, not with the demographics of the membership in the plants today. I just did a relatively long couple of email exchanges with a young man, and I wrote a relatively long one. It's about 4 inches long, and he responded back, I finally got somebody who works in the plant to say what I know is in their heads and their hearts, but I don't want to say that. I needed to get someone to say it, and he said it. And he said something to the effect is, listen, we know the union's got to be changed. We know all that. But look, we're just trying to get through the day in here. And when I go home, I am dog tired and exhausted. And all these people know, the temporaries and the tier twos, of just let me get in the long gray line, march into that plant, do my work, no matter how much I get abused, no matter how tired, exhausted I am, I just don't want to lose this job. I need this money. Now, by my estimates, in General Motors, there are 20,000 Tier 2s and temporaries in the plant today, in GM. And they're going to vote to keep their paycheck, period. It's not about the signing bonus. It's that paycheck.
The question
that,
I have, Dick,
that person more or less said that to me. I finally got someone in the plant to say it.
I know, but not, I'm going to go back. You're saying this shit about Holifield. You know, he left office on November of 13th. How the hell can you say he negotiated a contract in 15?
I didn't say he negotiated. They knew what they were buying, and they said that when Holifield went to the IEB, it's in the newspapers, to present an outline. Look, you got to understand, if Holyfield makes a deal and says, this will be the shape and form of the 2015 agreement, he will go to the IEB when they have their regular meetings and say, get on the agenda and say to Dennis, I want to outline where the Chrysler contract is probably going to be. The Detroit News said that Holyfield went there, but Iacobelli wrote his presentation for him. And he said what Iacobelli and Chrysler needed to be said to the IEB. That's in the Detroit papers. It's not a matter of negotiating it. Negotiations is just that little bit at the end where you formalize it and put it in a contract. People
so
have the laundry list.
From what you're telling me, they're already putting down the 2021 agreement, eh?
Of course they are. Of course they are. You think everybody just goes into their cold?
I'm talking, I guess you didn't catch the date. And I said the 2021.
The next contract is
3 years before the fact that that
the next contract, Jimmy, get as crazy as you want, it doesn't matter. I'm telling you how it works.
I'm just saying, why do we have contracts here if they do it 3 years before the contract?
So that they can get it in one book. With
they
a date
don't put
on
that
it.
Up for another year.
You got negotiations for a 2019 agreement, right? That's your next contract, right?
No, 18.
Correct.
All right. So, if you have a living agreement right now, okay? Do we all agree it's a living agreement?
Yep.
All right.
Yes.
So, why not just do what they did in 2009 and write a memorandum of understanding to the existing contract?
Well, that could be very well done. I mean, you've talked about that with all the open paragraphs with no language.
No, we never had this conversation.
Well, we talked about the open paragraphs with no language. All they got to do.
What I am saying is, they did it in 2000. Look, the National Top Committee did not bargain a 2009 MOU. They picked six people out of the plants. The Top Committee had nothing to do with that MOU in 2009 coming out of the bankruptcy. It was a memorandum of understanding to the 2007 agreement. There was no top committee on what you voted on in 2009. All you got to do is go on Google and go to UAW GM Report 2009, look on the back page, you're not going to find the top committee there. You're going to find six people that were picked out of the plants. They've done it with a national contract already.
Well, Dick, up until those 1982 concessions, our contracts were progressive. And
the
leadership cared what the membership wanted. When did that cease to be the case? Because now they only care about what the corporations want. And when did that start to change?
I think with the advent of the 82 agreement. And when you say that change, here's what I think that or it is. The sense that we are living, breathing human beings, not only who exist when we punch in and punch out for those 8, 10, or 12 hours, but that we have lives. Those contracts, up until 82 agreement, were negotiated not to give us a subsistence wage. They were negotiated to give us a life in society in addition to a job.
Right.
And that's where that stopped. The AIFs went from 3% every year for the life of the contract to a 3% raise, then a lump sum, then a 3% raise, then a lump sum. And then all of a sudden, COLA disappeared in 2009 and was diverted off to the VEBA. Because COLA is still there, but it's paid to the VEBA. But it's still in the contract, in the back of the contract. And then the next attack was in 2015, where we lost the 8-hour day. Now you have to work 40 hours to get overtime, not overtime after 8. So what they were taking away is the part of your wage that gives you a basic subsistence and then maybe a little better economic life, to the point to where now when you got your paycheck, you had enough money to get up on Saturday morning and say, honey, let's go to the mall and see if there's something we want to buy there. That doesn't exist for the workers in the plants anymore. They go to the store when they need something.
Well, they
so it started in 82, taking away your pocket money. And when they took away that, they start taking away your life outside the plant.
Paul, I think if you look, that's the same time or thereabout that the Warren memo came out, and they got it. If you, and I told you to read it, and if you read it, you will see we're there or beyond.
Everything they asked for in 1983, they've got today. It took a while, but they got it all.
Well, I think one of the most important things, Dick, is they pretty much thrown paragraph 78 out the window. You know, I mean, that was so that you could have a fair work pace.
Yep.
And, you know, I worked down in Pontiac Truck and Bus. I think it was from 87 through 93.
Okay.
And they really started tightening down on the work pace on the assemblers there.
Right,
you know, they
right.
just started loading you down to the point where you couldn't move. You know, and it's just amazing how they just given up the fight for any kind of dignity in the workplace at all. And when it gets back to what that kid was telling you about, when they just beat you right into the ground, you're 8, 9, or 10 hours, you're there. Yeah, what it kind of breeds is a sense of hopelessness and apathy, because everybody knows the union's supposed to be there for a reason, and that's to represent you and to give you a fair pace. And when that's taken away, it just leaves you feeling hopeless.
Well, what you're talking about, Paul.
I've been trying to tell you, Paul, these younger workers in the workforce don't know that feeling that you just said of. They've never experienced that. They don't know what it's like to have their hours being violated and come in Monday and, hey, they screwed your hours, you're going to get paid for it. Now it's, well, we'll get you to work next weekend so you can screw over Joe Q Lunch Bucket, who should have been offered work next Saturday. They don't do that. They don't understand the true philosophy of the union. Hell, they're afraid for their damn job.
You know, instead of these ambiguous terms, just read Article 2. To quote Tom Laney, read Article 2, and everything Paul is trying to say is listed there of the Constitution. It's not like
right.
the union is being immoral. The union is not doing what it says the purpose of the union is from the perspective of the worker, Paul. And that's all printed in Article 2 of the Constitution.
Right. It's there to improve working conditions and job security.
Yep, all that and more.
Yep.
Right. It says Article 2, to quote, to improve working conditions, create a uniform system of shorter hours, higher wages, health care, and pensions, to maintain and protect the interests of the workers under the jurisdiction of the International Union.
And we're going on the other direction on that road, and have been since 1982.
Amen.
Yes. You know,
and that language is the responsibility of the president of the International Union to be operationalized
right.
through his officers and the International Executive Board.
Right.
Those
right.
are his guidelines for the business of the IEB. And no one in the IEB is sitting there with that language in front of them saying, wait, stop. We're going in the wrong direction according to this. Those people collectively, but individually it's Dennis and the officers. and then the IEB in general. And that's what they're supposed to be doing in all things all the time. That is their morality fall.
Yeah.
Very simple stuff that does not take brain surgery. It doesn't take a bunch of ranting and raving of should be, could be, ought to be.
Yep.
That is what it is. That is what they're supposed to be doing in anything they undertake in that body. And in absence of that body, that's what the officers of the union, Dennis, the three vice presidents and the financial secretary, and the trustees, that is their guidelines of operation. That is their reason for being.
But our national agreement with General Motors calls for continuous improvement, right? Basically violates
the contract. Well, the contract calls for it now, yeah.
And basically that contract violates the UAW Constitution.
That contract violates the contract itself in the form of paragraph 8.
Yeah.
We have nothing to do with continuous improvement. I'm sorry.
Right.
Paragraph 8 says so explicitly.
Yeah.
It's none of our business.
Right.
Our job is to come in and do the written job description and then go home.
Right.
We are not required to help them run their factory. We are not required to sit in a team meeting and say, well, I think 8 of us can do what the 9 of us are doing, so let's do that.
Yeah.
Because you've got tier 1 people who do that religiously now. They eliminate themselves.
Yeah.
If they want to be that stupid, I got no comment for them.
Well, it's a very insidious process. When I worked at Truck and Bus, I got called back in 1984. In a 4-year period before that, I'd only worked 12 weeks. And they were talking about team concept.
Yep.
And I listened to the superintendent. I said to him, you know, basically what they wanted us to do was cut our own throats. And he kind of looked at me funny, but, you know that's what I said is they wanted us to participate in our own demise.
That's right.
And that's exactly what
we have done that gleefully.
Yeah.
We have done that gleefully since 2011.
Well, that's because, you know, Roger Smith badmouthed the auto worker as being useless and lazy. But the fact of the matter is, I think they really knew that most people would respond to a pat on the back or a pizza. And they've used
all I'm saying is, this wasn't done by Tier 2 and temps. This was done in 2011 by Tier 1 people.
Right.
This was done by seniority people.
Yeah.
This was done by anybody who voted yes on a national contract.
God, I can't remember.
It was done by everybody who punched in every day.
And say the last time I voted yes on a national contract would have been about 79.
I don't care how many voted yes or no. It was done by everybody every day. Beginning with the 2011 contract. And most of them were Tier 1 defined benefit pension plan people at that time.
And the Tier 2s who voted yes, they had the incentive too because they were going to get a pay increase, a $9
That's
hour
right.
pay increase.
That's right. And they promised them.
Don't blame because somebody voted yes on the contract. I said,
no, we're trying to say they were put bribes out there. You're not listening.
Right.
We're trying to say they were put bribes out there.
Trying to make excuses for those people.
Oh, my God, somebody else has an opinion.
All I'm saying is don't make excuses for what they did day to day in a plant. They did it.
Well, the International set up the framework. I remember right before I retired, Dick Shoemaker endorsed lean manufacturing.
Yep.
And that set us up for that whole thing.
Right. I guess I'm going to switch gears here for just a minute, if we can. There was some discussion on the floor about the steel tariffs coming in play. And I told somebody, I said, I think it's a great thing. I said, if we can return some manufacturing back to the United States, ask them folks in Allentown, Pennsylvania, what they'd think about having some work back to their town. And, of course, that starts a big political discussion, which I'm not getting into a political discussion. But then I see this week they were talking about General Motors come out and said this is going to raise their prices on them and in their supply chain, and that they're going to have to share that cost with the consumer, and that would also would probably lower their demand for their vehicles. And when I read into the article, I found out that they're saying that it could raise the price of a vehicle by up to $200.
And yeah, I read 300.
Wait a minute. 300, 200. All right. A lot of these guys are paying over $1,000 in destination charges. Some of these vehicles are paying, depending on what you get, you're paying up to $2,000 in gas guzzler taxes. And I'm thinking, you know, some of these outfits that we have, like the Denali and the package we have, that you're spending thousands and thousands of dollars extra on this. I guess what I'm saying, what's $200 or $300? You know, and then you're complaining about the price that you say you're going to pass on to the consumer. What about all the money you're saving by all your green technology at these plants that are running green, and that you're not paying any electric bill on them? I mean, you know, I'm not buying this, Dick. I'm just not. I'm not going to buy it. I understand that they say it's costing them money, but they're saving money in other places.
Well,
I got you
can't really talk about, only in an insane world can you talk about steel is going to raise the price of a $90,000 Suburban. You have to be that insane to think a Suburban is worth $90,000.
Right on.
Right.
Right.
So it's kind of an insane, when you start, because, you know, going back to Paul's thing, what is their actual profit on a $80,000 Denali coming off your assembly line? If you live to be 1,000, you'll never find out that number.
No, no. I know
so
back
to
in the day.
$300 in steel is kind of insane. Because
yeah,
these
on
prices
top of
are
the,
insane.
Yeah,
the
and on top of the savings
doesn't reflect
making
reality.
Right. And then on top of the savings of the temporary employees that we have. I mean,
well,
really?
you got 20,000 tier two and temporary and flex and long term temp and GM alone. So you could
That's
take a wagon thing to calculate how much money in any given hour of any given day in General Motors, the difference in your wage and 20,000 people who are making marginally half of what you get, and that is found money by the corporation.
That's like a seniority worker can't displace a temporary worker. He has to get laid off. Where the hell is that in our Constitution?
Well, that's not in this calculation.
No, they don't want logic, as you said.
Well, I'm just saying, if you got 20,000 people out there who are not making $30 an hour, and the average wage of the tier twos and the temporaries, I mean, if you just broke out the temporaries alone, they're all somewhere at basically half of that money. And the tier twos are somewhere around 30% or 40% of that money. That is found money. It's just delivered to the plant every day in a brown bag as pure profit.
It doesn't matter whether it raises the price of a car or not. The issue is national security. We've lost way too many steel mills. The thing is, a couple, 3 years ago, I was reading in the newspaper about all these soldiers have been injured and killed in these Humvees when these roadside bombs went off. And the government was looking at retrofitting these Humvees with armor plating. The only problem was there was only one steel mill left in the United States that made that kind of steel. And that's ridiculous, you know, that we're in that situation. You know, during World War II, Joseph Stalin said he did not fear the U.S. Army. What he feared was the city of Detroit and its industrial capacity, because he understood that's why we won World War II. And we can't keep losing industries that are vital to our national security. We can't rely on China to produce steel for us if we end up going into a conventional war against China or, you know, some of these countries
Anybody.
That we're getting our steel from. We have to get back to where we're producing our own stuff. And if we get more jobs, General Motors will have more, you know, more good-paying jobs in this country. General Motors will be able to sell more vehicles.
Yes.
That makes sense.
Well, they'll have at least $16 an hour temp workers.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, that's...
We are going to go to 8:30 tonight, so we've got about 3 minutes left in the show. It's been an interesting conversation. Like I said, just have to keep our eyes open, ears open, see what's happening down in Detroit way. And I agree with Paul. I think most of us would all like to see some work come back to the United States, especially people like Allentown, Pennsylvania.
Well, it's coming
just my
because
thought.
He's already instituted his new trade policy. So I think you'll see it come back, at least some of it.
Right, right. I mean, didn't Saginaw close down one of their foundries? I know they still
two
have
of them.
Graham.
General Motors used
they did
to
close
have
down
three
two?
Foundries. General Motors used to have three foundries in Saginaw. They only got one.
Right. I remember back in the was it the late 90s, early 2000s, the Germans were trying to buy up all the foundries from General Motors, and they wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
Well, so.
They just
all
closed
right.
them all instead.
So,
well, we get,
right. well,
you know, electric cars are not going to have all the underpinnings that a combustion engine car has. And moreover, we can
right.
also go to the plastic bodies that Saturn was using. We don't even need aluminum.
Right.
Well, the way the autonomous car has, you know, it's going to work on population control, too. Especially on poor kids on pedal bikes.
Yeah, they come out that and they said that the analysis, they're real skeptical of General Motors self-driving cars because of what happened this last week, and it's not the first time.
No, no it's not.
I think
it was
they're trying
in
to
California,
push.
Not one in Arizona, was it?
Right.
Yep. In Vegas, yeah. Vegas, there's one in Vegas.
Yeah, and all. If
I don't
I
know.
Believe right, were they not all on bicycles, or was one a wheelchair maybe?
Yeah. I think that was. Oh, geez. I don't know. So,
I'll let
well,
Tom
we,
get in
we got
the
about...
car with no steering wheel and brakes. I ain't getting in it. Fuck it, I'll walk.
I'm with you, brother.
I don't think any of us would get in one of those. But
no,
you know, that's old school. So we've got a minute, so I guess, Don, you want to start winding her down. And remember, there will not be a show next week. Enjoy your long weekend. Enjoy your family and your holiday. And I guess that's what we'll say about next weekend.
Yeah, everybody have a great Easter. Yeah. And Paul, I agree with you on the steel. And they found a map in Japanese that said that the first two cities they would bomb would be Detroit and Flint, Michigan. So they were the most important cities in our country at that time.
Oh, they're not anymore.
Not anymore, no.
Right.
Hopefully.
Right.
On behalf of Dick, Jimmy, Scott, Paul, myself, we want to thank everybody. Am I skipping anybody? I don't think so. I want to thank everybody. Everybody have a great Easter, and we'll be back in 2 weeks. So good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.